Are we set? The February 12, 2007 meeting of the Senate Public Safety Budget Division will come to order. Today on the agenda, we have presentations about the armor and CrimNet provisions in the governor's budget. When it was first presented to us, we had some questions and wanted more information, and so these good folks are back to tell us more about the program, and it looks like we have people from out of town who want to comment on these two programs as well. So why don't we get started right away? Mr. Leslie and Mr. Whitehead, go right ahead whenever you're ready.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tim Leslie. I'm Assistant Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I want to thank you for letting us have the opportunity to provide information to you today about the statewide interoperable radio system, otherwise known as ARMR. Seated next to me to my right is Mr. Ron Whitehead, the Program Director for ARMR 911 Program. Commissioner Campion could not be here, and he sends his regards. The plan for today will be that Mr. Whitehead and I will spend approximately 30 minutes with you providing information to you on the system, why it's important, its history and development, the drivers for this change, how we compare to other states, and why this is such an important issue right now. And then we'll take our questions. I'd like to acknowledge all our public safety partners that are here with us today, lending support. I really appreciate your presence. Thank you. And when we get started, we're going to have a short six-minute video designed to provide a baseline of information to you. This video was developed by the Metropolitan Radio Board, the group that governed the Phase 1 and Phase 2 of the build-out of the radio system, and the precursor to the current statewide radio board.
Good.
Backup.
10-01, you're in service at 16-01.
We'll need to close this exit off until we have party and vehicles clear.
We have one unconscious driver with a deep laceration.
In virtually any situation, the first piece of equipment emergency response personnel reach for is their radio. And at that moment, nothing is more important than the ability to communicate.
881 to Carver County.
Today, a growing number of law enforcement, fire, and emergency medical professionals, along with other essential public service users, begin using the new Minnesota Regional Public Service Radio System. This state-of-the-art digital radio network helps users at the local, county, state, and federal levels work more efficiently and safely. It delivers unprecedented interoperability among agencies, superior geographical coverage, unequal channel availability, and improved system reliability when, in an instant, everything changes and the difference between life and death can be measured in moments.
The technology and the capability of the 800 megahertz system surpasses what we have in the previous radio system. The firefighter, the EMS personnel, the police officer, the snow plow truck driver is going to have a radio that is going to be very reliable and is going to give them the ability to do their job every day.
It was a typical quiet afternoon in this Columbia Heights neighborhood when an elderly woman heard a knock at her door. The last person she expected was an off-duty and unarmed police officer who had been shot by an assailant without provocation.
What that shooting ignited was basically a 30-minute running gun battle.
With a gunman still firing on an innocent neighborhood, it was fast becoming clear that multi-jurisdictional communications capabilities would be stretched beyond capacity.
It was very chaotic. You had dispatching going on our Channel 1 primary south channel. You had communications going on MNCEF Channel 4. When this happens, not everybody is dispatching, not everybody's communicating.
Over 100 Minneapolis officers were on scene and available to assist Columbia Heights. But because the agencies were unable to coordinate their efforts via direct communication, gaining control of the scene was next to impossible.
We're probably already 2 minutes into this and realizing we don't have any communications with each other.
Officers were getting into each other's cars.
Hennepin County, Minneapolis City, Anoka County, and listening to each other's dispatchers.
And that's just law enforcement. What about emergency medical services? What about the fire departments that responded? That's where it became a real challenge to communicate effectively and coordinate everybody's efforts.
The ability to put hundreds of people on a single channel is just not feasible. You have to have the ability to break those people out and at different times reconnect them together. The current system just won't handle it.
While recent incidents at the local as well as national level draw attention to the need for change, it was already known as far back as the mid-80s that large metropolitan areas could no longer rely on separate, uncoordinated radio systems, some of which were installed before the Nixon administration.
Today, the complexity of our operations, although the fires haven't necessarily changed, the complexity of our infrastructure dealing with incident command, dealing with other outside agencies such as EMS, police, and the county sheriffs, has become a very complex operation.
The rapid growth of the metro area had outgrown the previous system's coverage. As large office buildings, apartment complexes, and other tall structures cropped up, coverage became increasingly difficult. As cities and suburbs grew, more agencies were needed, resulting in an acute shortage of frequencies. Lack of interoperability, spotty coverage, congested channels, coupled with radio equipment considered obsolete by today's standards, were the true catalysts for the introduction of the new 800 megahertz regional public service radio system. Today, emergency response teams will have the ability to connect with the people they need, when they need them. This enhanced level of coverage is made possible by a ring of transmitter and receiver sites placed throughout the metro area. Individual users can roam freely, even beyond jurisdictional lines, and still maintain communications with members of their home site. The regional public service radio system puts the unique ability to assign an unlimited number of incident-specific talk groups right into the palm of the user's hand.
Having the ability to talk directly to that entry team without outside interference would definitely enhance not only the operation, but provide for additional safety for the entry team and all the other team working environment.
In an era when the security of the state of Minnesota and its citizens takes on national proportions, interoperability with outside agencies and neighboring jurisdictions is crucial. And the ability to interoperate with other entities simplifies coordination efforts for superior incident management. The new regional public service radio system is dynamic in its design. It allows for the addition of a high-speed data layer with the capacity to deliver fingerprint data, mugshots, video, and the developing CRIMNET system directly into public safety vehicles in the future. In any emergency situation, nothing is more important to responding agencies than the ability to maintain open and coordinated communications. And when quick response times and positive outcomes can be measured in moments, the Regional Public Service Radio System delivers.
Madam Chair, members, just thought we'd show you that real quick. Sometimes a picture's worth a thousand words, or in this case, a video. As Assistant Commissioner, I chair the statewide radio board for Commissioner Campion, and I supervise Mr. Ron Whitehead, the program manager. I've been involved in this enterprise since 2003 when I came over from the St. Paul Police Department. I know that just enough about this system to be kind of dangerous, so hang with me here a minute. At the St. Paul Police Department, I had many positions on the department, but my experience on August 26, 1994, as a SWAT team supervisor during the search for Ron Ryan and Tim Jones, killer that day, still sticks with me. I didn't really understand it back then because, like many officers of the era, we accepted the communication systems we had and dealt with it. But on that day, I can recall I could not directly communicate with the State Patrol helicopter or the other SWAT team members that came to our aid that day. We were required to place a St. Paul police officer in the helicopter, and I would radio information to that officer who would then reiterate that information to the pilot. Later, when we conducted yard-to-yard sweeps, We had to intersperse St. Paul police officers among other SWAT teams so we could maintain command and control of the search patterns we were trying to find the suspect with. This inability of first responders to communicate in real time with those on the scene at a human-caused event or a natural disaster creates delays in action. In matters of life and death, these delays can have catastrophic consequences. I'm sure you've already heard of all the stories where communications failures plagued first responders. Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, Columbine, Oklahoma City. Closer to home, the St. Peter tornadoes, the riots in Mankato, the gas line explosion in St. Cloud, and many others. Creating communications interoperability, though, is much more than just a matter of technology. People talk about this concept like it's about getting the right radio or patching device, when in fact, true interoperability involves matters of leadership, governance, standard operating procedures, training, and the exercising of plans to evaluate if the system is operating as designed. This initiative to build out the armor system is contemporary. What you will learn today is that many states are building statewide interoperable radio systems. But we here in Minnesota are not leading the way. I would consider us in the second tier of states, ahead of some, but behind others. The Department of Homeland Security considers this their number one national priority for states, and their grant guidance documents are all very clear about that. This program area is the Department of Public Safety's number one priority as well, due to what we've heard from our customers as we've traveled across this state. I want to warn you up front, though, that you may hear some things about this enterprise from some skeptics. I don't know what it is about us first responders, but sometimes we're a little hesitant to change. But in my experience, the skeptics have one thing in common. They are not currently operating on the system. So I would politely ask that if you encounter a skeptic, ask him or her if they have experience with the system, if they know the capacities and the capabilities of it, and if they're familiar with its operational capacities as well. Some of those folks here today in the audience were once skeptics and are now believers. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Whitehead, who will walk us through the history and development of this system, its drivers, and the why we need to get this done now. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Whitehead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to give you an overview of the project and its history. And I'll at some point defer at the end to comments from other people and note that Mansell Mitchell, a former Assistant Commissioner of Public Safety, is here and probably has more history than many of us on this project. It's been around for a while and certainly time to move ahead with this one. Before I do that, I want to ask a couple of questions that seem to plague this discussion about the system. And it's referred to in the video as the 800 system, which is a bit of a misnomer today. We call it the armor system. It is an 800 megahertz-based system. It's an 800-700 megahertz-based system. Why are we in that spectrum? We're in that spectrum because that's where the growth of wireless communications for public safety at the state and local level exists. The FCC and Congress back in the 90s said to the FCC, ANITA, that does federal frequencies, we need additional spectrum. Law enforcement will need additional spectrum for not only voice communications, data communications in the future. Both ANITA and the FCC came back and said, we can't free up any more spectrum in the VHF range, and began to open up 800 megahertz for this for new public safety systems. They've since opened up a large area of the spectrum, freeing up TV channel or taking over spectrum that was part of the UHF TV range, and providing additional spectrum that's all compatible here in the 700 megahertz range. So, in fact, it's a 700-800 megahertz range, and it's where the growth of public safety communications into this next century is going to occur. Why trunk technology? It's a sophisticated technology to make, and the purpose there is to make better use of the resources we have instead of having a single channel that people can talk in that lays idle most of the time. Trunk technology uses spectrum much better. The dynamics, what's driving us to change to a new state-of-the-art communication system, aging systems. Most of the public safety communication systems were implemented in the 1970s. New technology, we're moving from analog to digital, the same as the rest of the world is doing, trunked versus conventional. And finally, the FCC mandates that in 2013 require everybody to upgrade their system to narrow band technology if they stay in the VHF range. So why now? This project has been discussed, and I'll go over that briefly, since 1995 is when the legislature first authorized the regional system. 2013 is coming along. It will take us 4 years to build this system, making it approximately 2012 before we'd have it implemented. And we need a system in place so public safety can transition effectively. Minnesota's plan for the armor system began actually with discussions back in the 1980s. When the metro area started discussing going to trunk technology. Metropolitan Radio Board was formulated in 1995 to come up with a plan for the implementation in the metropolitan area. Seven counties plus the two counties of Chisago and Isanti counties were added into that area. It was funded in 1997 when 4 cents of the 911 fee was allocated for sale of 911 revenue bonds. Phase one was implemented finally in 2001. Start of 2002, and in 2005 is when the Metropolitan Radio Board transitioned to a regional radio board. The legislature in 2004 had authorized the creation of the statewide radio board, which is a representative body of 21 members, seven representing state commissioners, seven representing metropolitan area local officials, and seven representing local officials from outside the metropolitan area formulate the statewide radio board, which has the authority over the plan, defines the plan, and defines the standards, the technical and operational standards of the system. What's our current status with respect to the build-out of the armor system? The metropolitan area, like I said, was developed or was implemented the backbone in 2001. At that time, Hennepin County, Carver County, City of Minneapolis also implemented their systems. Since that time, Anoka County has been added on. And I can tell you that at this point in 2008, the metropolitan area will be fully integrated into that system. And that's not just public safety in the traditional sense. That means that all governmental operations within the seven-county area will be operating on that system on a ubiquitous backbone that they all can interoperate with seamlessly. As far as the state plan is concerned, the implementation of phase three was funded by the legislature in 2005. I'll go back though briefly and give you a little history on the state plan. In 2001, a report was made to the legislature outlining the benefits of a statewide build out of the plan. Those benefits were in large part founded upon the fact that if we do it separately, it will cost us much more money and we will recreate the interoperability that we've got presently. If everybody implements their own system, they're likely to implement them at different technologies and different standards and will continue to institutionalize the interoperability we currently have. The 2001 report was made to the legislature. In 2002, the legislature adopted that plan and partially funded phase three. Regrettably, that funding we weren't able to build the system with that funding due to some issues with the 911 fund. But in 2005, phase three was in fact funded, and we're currently in the process of implementing that. In addition to that, the counties of Olmsted, City of Rochester, Stearns, City of St. Cloud have already implemented their system and been tied into the metropolitan system and are currently operating. And MnDOT is currently in the process of building phase three, which on this map here, you can see the blue areas. That's 23 counties outside the metropolitan area are currently in the process of being implemented. The original plan called for a phased implementation, phase three in 2003, phase four in 2004, phase five in 2005, and phase six in 2006. Regrettably, we've fallen behind that schedule to the point where right now, as I said earlier, it would be 2012 before we could get this system implemented. And January 1st of 2013 is when current users would become secondary on their systems and would have to and are due to replace their systems. Phase three, as I said, is being implemented right now. A better drawing exists right here of those and the network that establishes those. The state, MnDOT, is in the process of either taking existing towers, upgrading them, in some instances buying towers and implementing them. But we'll effectively have phase three in place by September of 2006 here. The 23 counties in central Minnesota and southeastern Minnesota, and as I said, Stearns County and Olmsted County are already in the system and operating. What I would draw your attention to is the fact that the metropolitan area, although not fully implemented, and the national priority with respect to interoperable communications, in November of this year, we participated in an exercise. And it was an evaluation of our tactical interoperability for the Urban Area Security Initiative, what's referred to as the USASI region. It was an exercise at the Mall of America, communications exercise, but also an explosive incident with many participants, multiple disciplines, multiple jurisdictions, federal, state, and county, and local responders. And it was evaluated by the National Department of, or the Department of Homeland Security. As a result of that evaluation, Minnesota, the Twin City USASI area, received a perfect score. And one of the things that you've been provided is a copy of that score sheet of the USASI area. It deals with three different areas. It deals with, first, the governance, and we were held to be at the highest level as far as the governance. It deals with standard operating procedures. We were found to be at the highest level of performance in the nation in standard operating procedures. And finally, it deals with usage, the ability of the personnel to come together and use the system to its advantage to provide interoperability on a broad scale. And I will note that out of 75 USASI areas in the state in the United States, only six received the perfect score in all three categories. Speaks very well to what this system has done in the metropolitan area. And I would note for you that, as the commissioner said, interoperability isn't all technical. It's the ability of people to work together, and then it's their ability when they come together to exercise procedures and apply those procedures to have an effective resolution of the incident. And that's what this tactical interoperability exercise demonstrates for us, is that not only do we have the backbone for that to occur, but that backbone has provided the collective working together, built the relationships, so when we're brought together to at the scene of a disaster, that we're able to apply that to the best effect for our citizenry. Finally, I'm going to move on to the governor's recommendations with respect to the armor system. The governor's recommended, and you'll find a sheet that's been handed out to you. The governor's recommendation provide that we begin design, or that we complete the armor backbone. In other words, build it in the 55 remaining counties of the state of Minnesota by 2012. It calls for us to begin the detailed design work in phases 4, 5, and 6, to begin the site acquisition work, to upgrade the metro backbone, maintain the highest level of interoperability. I'll be entirely honest with you. Because we've delayed this for 5 years, the metropolitan area needs to be upgraded so that there's totally interoperable. And begin construction in June of 2008 would be, once we've done the detailed design work, upgraded the metro area, and given us an opportunity to do some of the lead site acquisition work. Funding for the backbone and then provides for funding for the backbone operating costs. Two big questions on everybody's mind as we talk about this is, first, will it get here? Or first, well, what will the operating costs be? Second, will it be here? Governor's recommendation provides for both of those by saying we'll get it built by 2012 and we'll fund the cost of the backbone so that those people operating on the backbone won't have to pay an operating cost with respect to that backbone. Funding for the governor's recommendation is a one-time appropriation out of the 911 fund for fiscal year 2008. Then it provides for an increase of the 911 fee of 10 cents in fiscal year 2009, 10 cents in fiscal year 2010, 10 cents in fiscal year 2011. That provides funding for $62 million in bonds in each of those years, a total of $186 million to build the system throughout the remainder of the state. I will note and did hand out information to you on where the 911 fee lies in the state of Minnesota. And at the present time, we're approximately in the middle of the pack. Out of 50 states, and then 51 including the District of Columbia, we're approximately in the middle. This would put us up in the upper third, but not would not which it would not put us at the highest level. Beyond that, I'll open it up for questions, and then I believe comments from the many people that have shown up here.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? This is a lot to absorb. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I guess I don't know if you're the right person to answer this question, but the surcharges on the telephone bills to pay for this armor expansion, do they accrue to cell phone bills also or only landlines?
Madam Chair, members
Mr. Whitehead.
Of, Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, they do. The cell phones are paying the same fee that the wired line providers do. And I manage the 911 unit also, so I'm involved in that piece also.
Thank you.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to make sure my picture of this is accurate. For $62 million a year, we're building backbones, which is what? It's basically a series of towers along that we call the state backbone, but then it's up to the local governments to build additional towers and acquire radios that we contribute 50% of the cost of? Or what? Tell me where what the money is being spent on in terms of hardware.
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you're correct. In phases 4, 5, and 6, this would pay for the cost of the backbone. As part of the detail.
What is the backbone?
Oh, the backbone. I'm sorry. And the backbone is, in fact, the approximately 200 towers, some of them existing, some of them new, that provide basically coverage about every 20 miles apart to provide an overlay of coverage across the state. The local enhancements to provide additional capacity and or coverage are not part of that backbone, but the backbone does provide a basic level of coverage throughout the state.
Well, Madam Chair, so the state will be paying for all the towers across the whole state. What is the local responsibility then?
Senator Nouvelle, the locals would be responsible for if they needed additional capacity, which means additional channels in the system to carry their traffic load, or if they need enhancements which would be additional coverage because of population base and so forth, they would provide that. And I'll give you an example. The metropolitan area here is the backbone was probably about $36 million, but the local enhancements were are in the range of about $100 million in local enhancements. Now, that's a very populated area. In some cases, you know, the downtown metropolitan area where, you know, towers were required fairly close to penetrate the buildings, but the local communities paid for those, that piece of the enhancements, both channels and both towers to improve the coverage.
Okay, so Madam Chair, when you say enhancements, local enhancements, that still means towers. When they have to be closer than 20 miles or something because of population or otherwise.
It's towers and channels, you're correct.
And let me clarify one more thing. Is this 800 megahertz band, and there's lots of frequencies, I guess, within that. Is that optional? Or because somewhere in one of your pieces it says that the local governments can do it on a voluntary basis. I guess I was of the impression that it had to be – that it was required. Once we build it out, that was part of the whole homeland security concept, was that all the public safety folks would be on the same channel.
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, it is optional. The statute requires that it's optional. As long as we have overlapping coverage, we can link systems together. For the maximum level of interoperability, and ideally, you would like to see all public safety officials on the same system. But it's entirely possible that a county, and in fact, there are some counties have bought new VHF systems. Because we have overlapping coverage, we can simply link them together with a push of a button and tie them into a talk group, and we create that interoperability when we need it.
Do people understand that?
Yeah, a little.
No.
I'm not sure I understand. I mean, if you can get interoperability with VHS, then what are we doing 800 for?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the backbone is what provides that interoperability, is the ability to link them through that backbone into the different frequency ranges and provide the interoperability.
All right.
Okay. Senator Rosa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Leslie and Mr. Whitehead, I have several questions. I fortunately get to represent an area where there are the non-believers, and the non-believers called me. So, yeah, so hang on. I think it was fairly unclear how much this is going to cost, the total project, how much is this going to cost for all the regions involved?
Mr. Whitehead?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosine, the backbone in phases 4, 5, and 6, our estimate is that it's $186 million. Currently, phase 3 is $145 million for the backbone. Local enhancements is an issue that we're not entirely, that depends on the community, what level of coverage they're looking for. I know there's many counties in your portion of the state that the backbone will provide them with very good coverage, much, much better than they have, and then provide them with interoperability besides. And you really can't, you know, Rochester is an example, Olmsted County, where the backbone provided them with, they put one tower in the city of Rochester, otherwise the basic backbone provided them with coverage. So it's really hard to say exactly what the level of, what are we going to have to do locally. Pat Maduri, a sheriff here from Itasca County, is building a system, and basically that the coverage provided by the basic armor plan provides him with good coverage in his county.
Madam Chair,
Rose,
Mr. Whitehead, so basically for a county such in Greater Minnesota, especially one that borders a surrounding state, they are going to have two systems still in place, because many of the smaller communities in those counties that are served by one dispatch will not be able to acquire any 800 megahertz, or they're still going to have two systems for their fire department. They're going to still have to have two systems in their squad cars. Is that correct?
Mr. Whitehead?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosine, no, that's not correct. They should be able to, where they need to, provide a link to their system. For example, my background is I spent 30 years with the Bloomington Police Department, retired in Bloomington, and paging quite frequently is done on a VHF channel. But you simply link that into a talk group in that area, so that you can scan that talk group, that VHF, fire VHF talk group, and hear the pages and hear what's being said on their channels, if in fact that occurs. So it's not necessary to carry two radios. There's other issues, like you say, with respect to bordering states. Wisconsin is a VHF, South Dakota is a VHF state. Iowa is currently not made up their mind what they're going to do. The people I've talked to have talked about an 800 system because it's where we've been assigned to grow in. But there are some interoperable needs that are difficult to address beyond our border.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. These counties that do want to have just one system, it will be a tremendous cost to them, I would assume. If they want not to have two systems in place, they're going to have to buy into the one system, the 800 megahertz. And then the counties that are surrounded by South Dakota, Iowa, and even Wisconsin, which I understand that you have a central locale for the 800 megahertz, which is the larger metro area, but Greater Wisconsin is VHF. Is that correct?
Mr. Whitehead.
There's several questions in that one. Sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wisconsin is, they ultimately have a plan. They're hoping to do a VHF trunk system. They've continually been frustrated by the fact there's no room for growth there. Their plan basically, and this is something I've come to realize, that VHF or interoperability means different things to different people. Interoperability Wisconsin's VH or interoperability plan looks to mutual aid county to county and task force and operability, really, in large part. And they took a few frequencies and have tried to clear those up. So statewide, there's a couple of channels that everybody can operate for mutual aid. Wisconsin is a VHF. You know, now I think I'm kind of lost track of what your question was.
Sorry.
And maybe I could ask you to...
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Whitehead, if you have to have two systems, and it will still cost the county to just go to one system, right? There is a cost to each county to go to one system. Is that correct?
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there are... They're portables and mobiles, if they want local enhancements, in other words, additional capacity or additional coverage. The history has been that we've provided some sort of funding up to 50%, and the governor's recommendation recognizes that that's probably an expectation. Will people have to buy portables and mobiles? Yes, they will. They're going to have to buy portables and mobiles for new radio systems also.
Mr. Whitehead, how much do those radios cost?
Madam Chair, they can vary. There's three different vendors now. In fact, there's more out there. They can from $1,300 a radio to $4,500 a radio. What I would tell you is that VHF radios, if you're going to buy a digital VHF radio, they are comparably priced. If you're going to go to analog, which is very much like taking the technology to the 70s and into the next century, you can buy those less expensive, just like you can buy 8086 computers pretty cheaply now, too.
Can you still buy an 8086 computer? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a few more questions. And perhaps this is the PR that we need to do on this system, because from what I understand is if you've started back in 95 working on this project and you have four more years to go to build it, to outstate, is the 800 megahertz going to be outdated by the time we reach our goal? And is there enough 800 megahertz frequencies out there for the entire state?
Questions. Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, yes, there are. In fact, that's why the FCC has opened up 700 megahertz and a broad range of spectrum out there so that we can have communications into the future, including data communications has been allotted. So as far as 800 megahertz, it's 800, 700, bottom of the 800 and top of the 700, and they've opened up broad spectrum for public safety. As far as the technology, it's hard to speak for technology. I do know this is the, technology that everybody is implementing today. There's nobody of the 10, 15 states that are doing statewide systems and currently doing them. This is the current technology, 800, 700 trunk technology with digital technology. What I would caution you to note is that 30 years from now, there may be a new technology out there for wireless communications, but it doesn't overcome the laws of physics. We still need towers, and we still need connectivity between those towers. And I can guarantee you that public safety is going to continue to need spectrum to be able to communicate voice, data, and those kind of things to bring them to law enforcement. So this provides the backbone for that. The wireless piece is a portion of the piece, but putting that backbone throughout the state will serve us well into the future.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen. Mr. Whitehead, who carries that wireless portion? What company? What is it?
Motorola is the backbone. The wireless, the RF piece is a Motorola backbone.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Does that Motorola cover the entire state? Is there a carrier like Nextel or Sprint or somebody like that?
No.
Madam, Mr. Whitehead.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Senator Rosen, no, it's they don't carry the entire state. It's the system that we've implemented. Now, what I would note for you is the fact that when we acquired the major pieces for Phase 3, we did that at what's referred to as a 7X level. And part of that is the 7X level is an ISSI. It's an inter-subsystem interface to the P25 standard that has been talked about as far as a national standard.
Okay, now we're lost.
Okay.
Put that in English.
The only point I wanted to make, if I could, is the fact that it is possible as we move ahead that other vendors may in fact be capable of providing backbone pieces. We're looking at that intently, and taking the year to do the detailed design work and the RFPs will give us an opportunity to see if, in fact, even that backbone may be able to be provided by other vendors. There's only a couple that do systems of this significance, but that's a possibility.
And, Madam Chair.
Senator West.
I'm winding down.
I promise.
I think the only comment I want to say, and I know this is true out there, that out in greater Minnesota, most of the correspondence is by cell phones. And we have very limited carriers out in greater Minnesota who handles this. So I'm hoping that whoever, what city, like Redwood already put in a, Redwood Falls put in a digital VHF, apparently, is that this can still, yeah, I know, this can work and be implemented into a system that's already in place where these communities have already spent a large portion of their money to follow along with technology, and then they are looking down this, seeing these huge figures as far as what they feel like they have to when the system is kind of already working for them, they're making it work by their cell phones, and they're already servicing their small communities too. So.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, members. Yeah, I just wanted to kind of come back around a little bit here. All responses to disasters, regional events are local in nature, and so the local units of government are the ones that are going to come forward. If they're overwhelmed, they're going to go to their partners. And that's Chief Munn from St. Cloud calling in to see how things are going. So just sorry about that. And so when they ask for the regional partners to come, if the regional partners are on an interoperable radio system, then they're more likely to come and be able to create interoperability and to be able to address the needs of the community that they're trying to respond to. If each group is on different systems, you don't have interoperability, you have delays in action, and you have an inability to get the services to the public. And that's kind of where we're going. That's why one system is the way to go towards the perfect interoperability piece. The other piece that Mr. Whitehead touched on but kind of we skirted real quick was that to build these towers is something necessary for the future, and that we will build onto that not only a radio system but also a data system where officers and public safety officials will get data information into their cars, so they're much better able to respond to situations that they face. They have real-time information on suspects, they're not lagging behind, and they're up to the speed of what most metro area departments have right now. So that system needs to be built and leveraged as well in the future. And from what I understand is most counties in greater Minnesota will be able to ride on the backbone without adding towers. So there won't be any additional cost except for the mobile radios in their cars and the portable radios that they carry. And as Ron said, we've already have history in phase three, phase two, of paying for 50% of that for every county. So I just wanted to bring that back around. Thank you.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might just start with a comment. I those of you that know that I've been in law enforcement a long time, been around a long time when it comes to radio communication, seen an awful lot of where we've been, where we're going, and where we should be going. So being in a long time, not back to smoke signals, but almost, not quite as old as a couple of sheriffs sitting in this room, I would say. But nevertheless, this system here has been a long time coming. And I just need to make that comment. I got some questions too, Madam Chair.
Go right ahead.
The dollars that you're talking about over the next years on a dime a year per telephone service is going to be an awful lot of money. When this backbone is up, what is going to happen with that money at that point? When that backbone is already in there, am I able to tell my constituents that the service is now going to we reduce in price, or are we going to continue with those 911 dollars?
Sunset
is the, I guess maybe that's the answer.
Mm-hmm. Mr.
I guess, excuse me, I guess what I would like to see is that the ongoing dollars stay there and it can address the issues that Senator Rosen is talking about, is to help the office help the different departments in the state of Minnesota with some matching dollars to purchase the equipment to get on this particular system. Is that something reasonable or looked at all, or has that been looked at after the whole the backbone is up statewide?
Who'd like to answer?
Right, Ron.
Mr. Whitehead.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the proposal exists right now and based on the history of the plan, the 911 fee will remain at that amount for approximately 15 years to pay off revenue bonds. They provide for revenue bonds to come up with the necessary funds to build the system. And we did just sell revenue bonds, did very well with them for in the phase three. Those bonds actually, we got the amount that was allocated, they came to an 11-year scale, so they'll be paid off in 11 years. Similarly, the 4 cents that was authorized back in 1997, they're refinancing those bonds, and they'll actually be sold off earlier also. Now, the statute, it's been commented on before, the statute does, in fact, with respect to the 4 cents, says that when those bonds are sold, then the fee should be reduced.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, another follow-up. The liability. Who's going to have the liability for the backbone of the system? I don't know if that's been talked about.
Mr.
White.
Does
the state carry that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, basically the state, the Department of Chapter 403 states that the Department of Transportation owns, operates, and maintains the backbone of the system. So it's essentially the state's responsibility to make sure that's maintained and operational.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, so that's a good comment to be able to bring out to my local sheriffs, rural sheriffs statewide, is that the state is going to be doing the liability there. Is another question is MnDOT themselves the I understand that they're going to be on that system as well, so this is a we're talking snow plows, everything. It's going to be able to use this statewide.
Mr. Whitehead.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. It's a state system so that the state agencies can go onto it, and designed with the intent that locals can go onto it also.
Madam Chair, clarification on that.
Sure, go ahead, Senator Rosen.
Excuse me, Mr. Whitehead. What state agencies? I thought it was just MnDOT and State Patrol.
Mr. Whitehead.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, State Patrol, BCA, the bulk of Department of Public Safety, DNR enforcement is currently on the system. Corrections is looking to go on the system. Once you get a broadly based communication system of that nature, then other agencies will go on it. Emergency management and our disaster preparedness is requiring more and more of our agencies to be integrated into a communication system. Department of Health certainly will be looking at in the future any number of capabilities once we've got it in place that it will hopefully become the communication system of government throughout the state of Minnesota at all levels so that we've got the interoperability we need to respond to any kind of incident.
Thanks. Senator Ingebrigtsen, are you done? For a while?
Just one follow-up, Madam okay. Chair. Thank you. You said that there was still something missing in the metro as far as funding. What is that? How much money is that going to take?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the only issue or the only point in the governor's recommendation is the upgrade of the metro, which was implemented in 2001 to bring it up to the 7X controller. There's a portion of funds allocated so that we're all on a common platform, extending the useful life of the life cycle of that platform throughout the state. All 7 counties in the metropolitan area will be fully integrated. There was funding allocated in 2005, $8 million from the 911 fee for revenue bonds to assist them in their final implementation. So that funding was allocated. But Washington County and Scott County will be the last 2 counties in the 7 county metropolitan area to fully integrate onto the backbone in 2008.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Whitehead, it's a delight to hear you talk about things that have been dragging on for, it seems like, 40 years, and not so certain that I'm very wrong on that. But looking at that, and we're talking about a situation in the movie or the show that you gave early on of 100 Minneapolis officers being in Columbia Heights to help out, how are those folks all going to be using any one or two or three different channels consolidate all those? How does that work?
Mr. Leslie.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I think one of the nicest features of this system is that when you create your interoperability, you need to get together with your partners and talk about how you will communicate, who will be in charge when the bad thing happens. So you're already talking about it. You're already designating a channel, who's going to be the lead, how we're going to communicate, which we currently do not do. Most agencies right now do not communicate with their partners and say, by the way, when the airplane goes down on our border, who's in charge and how are we going to communicate? That doesn't happen. This system forces those agencies to get together and sit down and hash that out before we allow them onto the system.
How does that occur? I mean,
long, ugly meetings.
If you're looking at it, you know, my comments earlier about this being there 40 years ago or something in that nature, the fact is that there's no easy way to take it in, you know, who's in command and all of those issues that really have to deal with. Are you going to say Columbia Heights is going to be in charge of the 100 Minneapolis police officers? Is Minneapolis police going to do that? Is the Hennepin County Sheriff going to be there and do it? Is the State Patrol going to do it? There are all kinds of people involved in this.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I believe Yulee Seals, who's the chief in Bloomington, is here and was one of those key people that put together the tactical interoperability plan for the metropolitan area, resulted in the perfect score. And I would submit to you that we are, in fact, working on those issues. The mandate for National Incident Command Model has caused us to sit down and work on many of those issues. In addition to that, this system gives us the resources to implement that. It's not everybody jumping on MNCEF and saying, you know, I'm coming and where should I go? It provides the resources so that the EMS people can call in on an EMS routing talk group and find out where they should go so the people in charge can deploy their resources the most effectively.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Whitehead, it still doesn't answer my question. If you're looking at what happened in Katrina, mm-hmm. and the Louisiana State Police have the radio system there, but the radio system wasn't worth anything because there were too many people on it, and there was no way to solve that issue. There was nobody in charge. The same thing happened in 9/11, that the firemen couldn't talk to the police, they couldn't talk to the port control police, and they couldn't talk to the state police and all of those things, and ambulance service and so on. This is going to be the same thing. You're going to have to figure out who's going to run that. There's New York still hasn't solved that issue. And I know this, that in this group, there isn't going to be, if the sheriffs and the others start saying we want control of this or that, that this group here, these legislators are going to have a very difficult time allocating that. And I guess I'd like to know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I'll take a shot at it, Madam Chair, Senator Foley. I think in the Columbia Heights situation, your Columbia Heights would take command of that situation. There would be a tactical interoperable channel assigned. where resources would respond when they are coming to the scene as requested. There would have to be a command structure put in place to address those resources and then allow those resources to be utilized by the incident commander, who was identified locally, the Columbia Heights Police Department, the Columbia Heights Fire Department, whoever happens to be in charge. What Homeland Security Presidential Directive number 8-6, I can't remember which, is that everyone gets trained in the incident command system across this nation, all first responders. So we all will have an understanding of what that is. And so we will know how to operate within that realm. And hopefully we will avoid those kind of situations where everyone just shows up. That was part of 9/11. Firefighters just showed up. They didn't have radios. They were self-dispatching themselves there. And that happened in St. Paul when Ron Ryan and Tim Jones were killed. All of a sudden, SWAT team members show up, no radio, no acknowledgement from their home department that they were even there. And so then you have to manage resources that way as well. You know, who are you? Where are you coming from? And how am I going to communicate with you? But the training that's been mandated by the federal government that we all participate in will hopefully move us in a better direction towards, so everyone knows they're integral in the solution, but they got to know their role in that and that they don't come to a situation and make it worse.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
When you look at this situation, Mr. Leslie, you look at what Homeland Security has done and what they haven't done, and my view there is that I certainly wouldn't rely very much on Homeland Security to have any input in this type of thing. They got one of the worst records that we could possibly have. So in that situation, I really am not caught up as to how this is all going to work out.
Well, Senator Foley, maybe you can have some more conversations with these folks as we go along. I know we have a lot of folks from out of town who have come to talk to us and give us their opinions on this, and I'd like to have an opportunity for them to speak, if we could. And I don't have a list of names, so maybe just a couple at a time come on up to the table, and we'll start out with the guru.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mansell Mitchell. I'm an unemployed folk singer. I have the Trivial Pursuit distinction of having been named Acting Commissioner of Public Safety by both Governors Ventura and Governor Pawlenty. I retired in February 2003. Prior to that, I was a police chief for 19 years and a police officer for a lot of years before that. I had the privilege of being Senator Latz's police chief in St. Louis Park for 13 years and Senator Neville's police chief in Northfield for 4.5 years. I have been, the date 1995 has been cited. Actually, this planning process by those of us in the lunatic fringe goes back to the late 80s, and the planning, I've characterized this as the little engine that could. At this point, we should probably call it the big engine that must. But I chaired a Metropolitan Council committee called the Metropolitan Radio Systems Planning Committee, which was the precursor to the Metropolitan Radio Board, which is the precursor to the Straight Radio Board. So I've been involved in this for about almost, 20 years. And I think all of the questions that the senators have had are very germane to the issue, and we have talked about these things over and over again. And I'm going to try to use a couple of simple analogies. With your telephone, you can call anywhere in the world by simply dialing your telephone, and it works. The situation that we have in radio communications and some of the technologies that we're using today are World War II technologies, don't work that way. In 2001, when we began testing the metropolitan system, I excitedly ran into then Commissioner Charlie Weaver's office with a 5-watt portable radio and said, "Listen to this." And I talked to a MnDOT engineer at Water's Edge, and I talked to another engineer in Apple Valley. And I was so excited, I was almost jumping up and down. And my dear commissioner said to me, "Well, don't they all do that?" And basically that's it. They don't all do that, and they never have done that. And if we build this with that $186 million sticker shock number that's been cited, we will be able to do that. If we don't do that, these various jurisdictions, all of whose radio systems are wearing out at different times, are going to be, as Ron White had said, building non-compatible technologies. And it will be at an expense that is greater than $186 million sticker shock number that we're dealing with. And not only will it be at a greater expense, it will be much more difficult to have the interoperability, which now, you know, given the events that have been cited in our current level of concern about all of the horrible things that might happen to us, it's essential that we have this interoperability. I'd like to reference just a little bit to Senator Foley's question about, you know, how are we going to get this all together. We're going to have to create a new paradigm for planning our tactical interoperability. In other words, we're going to have to do things a little differently than we have previously. As Commissioner Leslie cited and Ron White had cited, you know, usually we don't pull the trigger on anything until something bad happens. And then all of a sudden we start flying this thing by the seat of our pants. What we're going to do now with this system is we're going to make all kinds of plans and cooperation ahead of time to make us better able to do that. We have a wonderful history of cooperation and collaboration in law enforcement, public safety in Minnesota, and we have the capability of doing it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Mitchell, since you were around, I'm curious, how did this get into transportation instead of public safety?
The Department of Transportation historically has been the owner and the builder and the operator of our state infrastructure. The Metropolitan, and I can't cite the history. Andy Terry is here from MnDOT. He can answer that question better than I can. The Metropolitan Radio Board essentially contracted with MnDOT to be the agency to own and to operate the system.
Okay.
All right, good. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
Thank you.
There are a bunch of men in, looks like they're all lining up to come talk to us. So. There are three or four chairs there. Why don't three or four people take the seats?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Steve Borkhardt. I'm the Sheriff of Olmsted County in Rochester, Minnesota. I also represent the Minnesota Sheriffs Association as the chair of their legislative committee. And with us also, who will be up here from the Sheriffs Association, is Sheriff Pat Maduri from Itasca County and Sheriff Bud Olson from Carver County. The Sheriffs Association stands firmly in support of this. It has been our number one legislative initiative for the last several years. We feel very strongly that we need to get this backbone built so that we can then tailor individual needs to individual counties out in the hinterlands and around the fringes. I'd like to speak real briefly to the most common objections, some of which Senator Rosen was referring to, that we hear from sheriffs from smaller counties and particularly those on the borders. Number one, that it's going to cost too much money, that they could buy VHF equipment for much less money to upgrade their radios. And as you heard addressed by Ron Whitehead, that is not the case when you look at the new VHF radio equipment that is going to be required by the FCC. Secondly, it will not give them the interoperability within their county and with neighboring counties. The number two objection is that it will not be compatible with counties and law enforcement agencies across the border, South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Canada. That may be the case, However, there are new technologies that have been emerging just in the last few years that will allow VHF systems to talk directly to 800 megahertz trunk systems. And the important thing for us is to get our backbone built, and then we can explore some of these other technologies that could be the solution to some of those interoperability issues. Number three, that it won't work in some of the areas where the topography is quite diverse, for example, in southeastern Minnesota, because 800 signal does not follow the topography as well as a VHF signal does. In Olmsted County, we have our fair share of hills and valleys on the east and southeast areas of the county, and we have implemented this 800 megahertz voice system in addition to a data system. And indeed, we have found that it does track with the topography quite well, and we have fewer dead spots with our new 800 system than we had with our VHF system. We all knew where the dead spots were with our old systems. They'd been around since the beginning of radios, and we had accommodated them into our response plans. And we have found that we have better coverage with the 800 megahertz. So this notion that it doesn't follow the topography as well is not proving to be the case in actual practice. Last but not least, they're concerned about change because this project is driving brand new relationships. Since the beginning of time in radios, we've all gone out and bought our own radio. We have been assigned our own frequency. Every little police department, fire department, ambulance company, and sheriff's office has been free to go buy their own stuff. But their stuff doesn't talk to each other necessarily. Now, very often, they've made interoperability patches with their primary business partners. But that doesn't help them if they need to go another county away to be able to coordinate and talk, which we found happens not infrequently. For example, just a few years ago with the St. Peter tornado is a real good example, and we've had others within southeastern Minnesota. I won't go into the details of them, but it's not infrequent. Last but not least, interoperability isn't just about law enforcement agency to law enforcement agency. The system is sized to accommodate all governmental wireless communications needs. So if my deputies suddenly needed to go to Winona, Minnesota to help with a school shooting over there, their school system could be on the same system as their sheriff and as their police and as my deputies, so that with a keystroke in the dispatch center, they could all be married to the same talk group to tactically handle that situation. And that's a broader scale of interoperability than we've been talking about so far. So those are some of the answers to some of the most common concerns you're going to hear from sheriffs in the hinterlands. If we get this backbone in place, if we had gotten this backbone in place 10 years ago, we'd be past all of those hurdles. Part of what we're suffering from is it has dragged out too long. We strongly urge your support of this proposal.
Thank you very much, Sheriff. Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pat Maduri, Sheriff of Itasca County, up in the northern end of the state. I've been sheriff for the last 12 years, and as Assistant Commissioner Leslie stated, there are skeptics, and I was one of those skeptics quite a while ago. And I guess I did a 180 on this project. And it came to the realization that we got to do it together. And 6.5 years ago, we brought our public safety people together in Itasca County to talk about what we're going to do for communications because of a couple of events that occurred. And as sheriff in the county, they always turn to the sheriff, at least in a rural area in our county, fix it, sheriff. Well, to fix it, sometimes you got to bring people together, and that's what we did. And we'd probably talked for a good 3 years on what we're going to do. And in that first 3 years, we looked at a VHS system, narrowband to meet the 2013 compliance. Well, as time marched on and looking at the dollars and everything that was associated with this, this is where it really made me a believer that we need to partner up with the state of Minnesota on this system. Looking at the cost of a VHF and looking at the cost of 800 megahertz, there wasn't much difference between the two, at least the way we wanted to approach it in Itasca County. Realizing that our public safety people in the county were not going to be able to afford the radios in itself to bring everybody up to the same level of communication. With that said, I went to our county board, and I guess I've been blessed in that sense. Our county board is going to bond for this project. It's going to cost us about $9.4 million to make this project happen, and we hope to flip the switch come the end of this year. That's supplying radios for every public safety group in Itasca County, the EMS, which there are four ambulance services, 16 fire departments, 8 law enforcement agencies, and 14 first responders with it. Also on the partnering of it, and you talked about, Sheriff Borker mentioned, it goes beyond public safety. We've communicated with our county road and bridge and engineer's office. They're going to be coming on the system. Our county probation is going to be coming on a system, which they've never been on a communication system before. Our county land department is going to come onto the system. Our county assessor's office is going to be coming onto the system where they've never had communications before as well. We also have 3 public works from 3 separate cities that will be coming on the system as well. So when you sit down and look at getting things and bringing people together, that's what it's going to take today to make this system happen. And as a skeptic years ago, one, I guess I didn't want the state telling me what to do out in rural Minnesota, because it always managed to, here's what we need to do, and one shoe doesn't fit all. But in this particular case, we have to do it together. And you talk about a sheriff that had to turn around and do a 180 with other sheriffs when he went out and talked about, this isn't a system for us in rural Minnesota. Well, I'm one of those opposites saying this is a system for us, of bringing a system together that will all be on one system all the way around. And to me, it's the right thing to do. Our particular system in Itasca County is 40-plus years old, some components of it. So you can sit down and look at our newest part is 25 years old, and we don't have compatibility with all of our public safety workers, let alone the non-public safety workers in itself. A couple other points. With our system, and being we're the first one in outstate northern Minnesota that is even going to 800 megahertz, skeptics told me we're not going to be able to talk to you. You're going to be an island within yourself. Well, with the creating of an interop channel, we'll be able to talk with the 5 counties as well as the state patrol and the DNR within Itasca County. I've made meetings and talked with all the sheriffs in the neighboring counties, which would be Beltrami, Cass, Kuchiching, Aiken, St. Louis, as well as the state patrol captain and DNR regional officer that's in charge, and we'll have interop capabilities with each one of those law enforcement agencies that service in Itasca County. We alone cannot do it in Itasca County. We rely on every one of these partners, whether they're in the county or surrounding counties, to help us get our job done. Cost of portables. I can tell you 25 years ago when we updated just the sheriff's office system in itself, we paid $4,000 for a mobile radio back then. We paid $2,800 for a portable radio back then. The cost today for those same mobiles and portables, if I want to get the top-of-the-line radio today, I will probably pay less money than what I did back then. And we're not looking at the top-of-the-line radio. We're looking at a mid-tier radio, which is really going to cost us less on where we're at. We talk about partnerships further. We have to build 8 towers in Itasca County to make this system happen. We've developed partnerships with 2 power companies in Itasca County, where Great River Energy and Lake Country Power in Itasca County are building 1 tower because they need some communication system in itself. We partnered up with the state of Minnesota on a tower over in Deer River area, and we're partnered up with another private tower company on the east side of Itasca County that we're going to be able to put our equipment on. The other interesting point, we talked about local enhancements, and I'll say we're one of the fortunate ones, and I think it'll probably play out the same in rural Minnesota as well. When we developed our blueprint for our system on where our towers need to be, without communicating with the state of Minnesota, we had taken our blueprint and asked them to see their blueprint, and our blueprint lined up with the state of Minnesota, which tells me that we don't have to worry about the local enhancement standpoint, because the system that is built when our consultant and our project manager put it together showed us that whatever the state had for a blueprint, ours mirrors one another. So we're looking at, we're probably not going to have to do local enhancements to make the system work in Itasca County. One other point I want to make, the question about cell phones. Since we put our towers up in Itasca County, we're looking obviously for partners as well and want to rent space on those towers. We have 3 cellular companies that do business in Itasca County. Every one of them is interested in space on some of our towers in the county to help provide better cell coverage within our county. And we have 1 other private company that does inner business through radio waves that's looking at tower space on a couple of our towers in the county as well. So when you sit down and look at partnerships, I think, and not to pat ourselves on the back in Itasca County, but I think we've done a good job in developing partnerships, and this is the partnership system. So, again, I urge the committee, and I as a skeptic and turning into a believer, I support this project 100% and really encourage your support on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And the next person?
Madam Chair and committee members, good afternoon. My name is Mike Goldstein, and I'm the police chief with the City of Plymouth in northwestern Hennepin County. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon to speak with you about this important topic. And in order to create a context, I want to go back a few years. As the sheriff, I too was a skeptic because, quite frankly, pre-9/11, I had a radio in my squad car or on my belt that if I pushed the button and talked, someone would answer me. So for the most part, my needs were met. However, after 9/11, I had the opportunity to go to Arlington, Virginia for an after-action report on the attack on the Pentagon. And it was a three-and-a-half-day event where they detailed everything that transpired that day on 9/11. And one of the successes, as you contrast what happened in Virginia versus what happened in New York City, was the fact that they had a very sophisticated plan and they had the ability to talk to one another. Their interoperable system allowed for a massive response within the first 90 seconds of when the plane hit the Pentagon. In New York City, the police and the fire departments couldn't talk to one another, and if they would have been able to, lives could have been saved, especially the first responders, because some had knowledge that the buildings were coming down or potentially could come down, and others did not, and they were trapped inside. Coming back from that, we were lucky in Hennepin County in that at that time, our system was being put into, was being implemented. Our 800 megahertz system was being implemented. And again, prior to my experience out east, I was happy with what we had. I couldn't be more happy with what we have now in that we go to large-scale events, whether it be a hazmat situation, a fire situation, a SWAT call-out. And previous to our 800 system, our interoperable system, you were somewhat of an island, and you had to do a lot of cross-patching in order to talk to different entities or bring in somebody else from a different discipline and stand next to them to share communication. And if that was afforded to you, it could work, but that's not always the case. With the new system, that isn't necessary. It can all be done via computer, and it can happen on your radio. A couple of instances I'd like to bring note to. The Columbia Heights shooting, I was not there, but I did monitor it on my radio. And quite frankly, you could not tell who was in the zoo there. It was absolute mass chaos. And with an interoperable system, things could have been managed better. One of the concerns that was brought up previously was how, even though with a robust system in place, how are you going to manage these incidents? Well, part of the issue is a technology issue, and the other part is a personnel issue, and it's a planning issue. With the National Incident Management System, which we are all compelled to follow, we have done training after training after training, and we have inbred this system, this command system, into both police, fire, EMS, etc., in that the local entity owns the incident, and you bring in your mutual aid partners, whether it be other cities, counties, state, or federal officials, yet the locals still run the incident, and you branch out, and you offer tasks, and you delegate responsibilities, and it works quite well. So the system allows you to do that without having to bring people necessarily face-to-face. Case in point, we did a large-scale school exercise, active shooter exercise, at one of our high schools about a year and a half ago. There were 13 different agencies involved. Prior to our 800 megahertz system, our interoperable system, we would have had to have at least six people sitting at the same table to manage that incident so we could hear what was being done. In this case, we didn't need anybody necessarily face-to-face, although in the command center we were. We could share one radio system, have a number of talk groups on a bank, and assign different tasks, whether it be perimeter, whether it be entry teams, whether it be staging areas, whether it be media locations, whatever it might be, or interacting with the school. It was brought up before by the sheriff. We were able to talk to one another and manage it in a very comprehensive and consistent manner, and we were able to resolve the incident more effectively and more efficiently than we could have before we had this system in place. I represent the Minnesota State Chiefs Association here today. I'm a member of the statewide radio board, and I happen to chair the legislative subcommittee of the statewide radio board. This is a top priority for all of us in public safety and in public works, in that in order to manage an incident, whether it be a small emergency to a large-scale disaster, we need to be able to talk to one another in an effective and controlled manner. And we have some of the tools in place. We have the people power, we have the plans, and we have the organizational skills through the National Incident Management System. We just need the technology now to finish out the project. Thank you very much.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I apologize for still being trying to look at this visually, but help me understand, for example, use the drill that you talked about with 13 agencies. So they've all got 800 megahertz radios. Each individual agency still has their own unique frequency that's in the 800 band, but when there's an emergency, there's a way to just, they can all dial into exactly the same 800. Is that how it works? Or do they stay on their own and it goes into a central point that somehow puts them all together?
Madam Chair and committee members, you did answer the question.
The first one, yes.
Okay. We have our own individual talk groups or channels. However, at the time of a large-scale incident, you will be directed onto a common channel where you can speak to one another directly.
Okay. Thank you.
But thank you very much. Next, please.
Hi, Sheriff Bud Olson from Carver County, Minnesota, and I have Chief Randy Sorensen from the Waconia Fire Department. He represents all the fire chiefs in Carver County. Just a couple of points. I was elected in 98, took office in 99, and Carver County is a very small metro county. When I got there, this project was already underway. We didn't have a choice of whether we're going to the new 800 system or not. Carver County was the first county in Minnesota to actually go live on this system. And I never had the fortunate task, like Sheriff Maduri did, of having to put a project like this together. I will say my first encounter with Sheriff Maduri was at the State Sheriff's Board, and he was a very big skeptic of this. And knowing that I had this thing running already, we had great debates about this. And a couple of comments I want to make. Yes, the cost seems large today. Yes, it looks like a big bill to pay. But when we in Carver County were looking at the age of our system, which we were also a system that was 35, 40 years old, we couldn't find parts for ours. When we looked at our coverage, we had deputies that had to raise their portables in the air, literally, to get to a tower in some of the low-lying areas in Carver County. When we had fire departments that could not communicate with their fire personnel, and the chief can speak about that, the county board in Carver County took on a great task and said, we're going to go ahead and move ahead in this direction. And so what we know today is that our relative cost to build our own system, to build it ourselves, would have been equal to or greater than going on with this 800 trunked radio system. So I can sit here 8 years later and been working with it for a good 3 years and tell you how great it's worked for us in Carver County. I also want to say, Senator Rosen, I sit on the state board with some of those sheriffs down in your district, and I know what you speak of because they were at the last board meeting going, we're not in favor of this. But one of the things that we do have to do a better job of is PR, is this piece of it. Because you, under this interoperability piece, you can still come and talk on that 800 system. And so when the troopers down in your district have that 800 system working, your sheriffs will still be able to talk to them. The difference is, though, is they won't have the robust system to be able to put their public works on there like we do in Carver County. They won't have the ability to put their CART buses busing the seniors around. They call in to us today and give us information on crashes in the county. They won't have that robust system behind them. And one day they're going to have to make a decision like Sheriff Maduri did. Okay, now what do we do? And so this operating system, having it available, gives your county and your constituents a choice to make at the time they need to make it. But we'll still be able to talk to the South Dakotas and the Iowas and the North Dakotas. We'll still be able to communicate with this statewide system. The last point, and I'll turn it over to my chief here, is we had an incident in May of 2005 with a Waconia school event. And maybe you can remember we had a bomb, an alleged bomb put into a middle school, and they closed school for 3 days in my county over what's the right thing to do, because we didn't know who we had who had been doing these sending letters and stuff. This radio system allowed all of the first responders in Carver County to set up the incident command, to set up the system where we got all our users online and were able to put them in different talk groups, but still we were a coordinated public safety response to that incident. So I urge you to support it. I tell you that it's working well in my county, and that I'll turn it over to my chief.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to testify that I would too was a skeptic of the system. And back when we were entertaining this in Carver County, they sat down and they laid it out what the cost would be for each entity to take and rebuild their system over a period of time, which exceeded the cost of the system to implement the 800 system. That made a believer out of me, as well as the ability to communicate much better with all the other agencies within Carver County. As Sheriff Olson alluded to, with the bomb incident in Waconia, we were not only able to communicate better within the county, but also when the Bloomington Bomb Squad and Minneapolis Bomb Squad came out, we were able to talk to them, communicate with them prior to them getting there, and just be better prepared once they did get there. My full-time occupation is a public works director for the community. On a daily basis, I use the Anaheim Trunk radio system to communicate with law enforcement, which we contract with the sheriff's office, to handle daily events that may come up where we don't have to page out fire for an incident, whether it's questionable or borderline. So in a sense, we're saving the taxpayers some dollars in that regard as well. The main thing is that was brought up earlier is that some of the dead spots we had in the county, we have less dead spots now. Our system is very beneficial for the first responders. It allows us a lot of different options to fulfill our duties and become better prepared and without competing for airtime, if you will, in the event of a disaster. So it's not only on a big disaster, but it's also on a daily basis as well. I thank you for your time.
Thank you both very much. Who else is here to speak to us today?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Milo Bennett, and I'm the fire chief for the Centennial Fire District, which covers the cities of Centerville, Circle Pines, and Lionel Lakes, located in Anoka County. Anoka County went on 800 megahertz system in October of 2004. We did this after two extensive studies. One we started in 87. We studied all the alternatives to upgrade our radio system, which was originally put in the 70s. We didn't do anything at that point, mainly because of the cost. We went back and took a look at it again in 2001, and we did this with fire, police, and sheriff, and all the people involved in the study. And then we decided to go ahead, and that 800 was the only way for us to go. We were fortunate enough that the county commissioners supported that and funded a major portion of that. We added five additional towers in Anoka County, giving us a total of nine. We partnered with private tower people, as well as MnDOT, and then built some of our own. Prior to us going on 800, the fire service in Anoka County had one main channel, and then we had second channel we could talk to each other on that we shared with five or six fire departments at a time. One of the things that came about with 800, because of the technology and not tying up frequencies every time you have a different talk group, now every fire department has three of their own channels, so they can separate the suppression crew that's inside a building from the water supply people who are trucking water in, or the command function. So you can actually separate those functions, but we can all talk together also. We obviously can talk to all our police departments throughout the county. We can talk to the ambulance services that cover us. And it has really been a tremendous improvement for us. Somebody talked about the officers having to hold the radio up in order to transmit in part of the county. we had to go outside to transmit to our dispatch center from inside a building. If we were on a medical situation and we wanted to talk to dispatch or we wanted to relay to the incoming units, we had to step outside the building with our VHF radios in order to get that communication. We don't have to do that today. We work on a lot of calls with our police and ambulance service daily, and in fact, several times a day, and it's allowed us all to communicate. We have been on it since 2004. Again, coverage is much better than it was before. Thinking back to what we had would be, it's just like night and day. I can't say enough about that.
All right, thank you. Next, please.
Madam Chair, committee members, Dean Kapler, Fire Chief, City of Ramsey. I think I can sort of just take off on where Milo Bennett talked here. Anoka County did go online with the 800 system in October of 2004, and in later part of December of 2004, the City of Ramsey experienced a actual disaster. A building exploded, and I think it was the first time in Anoka County really got to put the system to a real good test. We, as a fire service, we brought in 16 agencies, including the City of Ramsey. And just hinging on what Milo Bennett was saying here, one of the big things is that if you're going to rely on that one channel that we can get off the main, because the county's still got to go on. There's other stuff happening in the county. But if you get off on that one channel, it is quickly going to become saturated. Whereas as an incident commander, if you can start sectoring that communication into different blocks that make sense, it can all stay effective. And I think one of the main things is the safety of our responders and the people around there. If there has to be some real priority communication that has to happen and an incident commander needs to hear it, you don't have to wait for everybody to quit talking. You have a certain channel set up for that. That's priority communication. And with this system, I think you have that flexibility to segregate or sector off those communications to make that happen. And we certainly experienced that. We weren't walking, we weren't sprinting with the system yet, but we were certainly jogging. And I think it was an experience that helped us all learn a lot about it. And frankly, I think the system worked wonderfully.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be brief and wrap it up here. My name is Buck McKelp, and I'm the president of the State Ambulance Association. The Minnesota Ambulance Association represents fire-based, hospital-based, not-for-profits, privates, and municipal-based ambulance services in Minnesota. And I'll take a little bit different spin. I work for North Memorial, and we have large access to the 800 in the metro system here, and it works phenomenal for us. A few recent big bus accidents where we've had 14, 15 ambulances respond, 3 or 4 helicopters. And the incident, I heard the manager run the thing from Bloomington as he was leaving his office for the line of medical transportation. And that's my experience here. But I'll go into outstate Minnesota, where northwest and northeast Minnesota, we currently don't have communications on our VHF systems. We hear this loud and clear at outreach meetings we have in the areas where they say, you're talking about 800 in the metro. We can't talk on our VHF systems now. Some of them don't get their ambulance pages. Some of them can't talk to their system. Just the Great Plains area, Northwest, and Roseau EMS, those two services cover about 4,000 square miles of service area. They'll say how they have to relay between 2 or 3 different PSAPs to get back to the PSAP that dispatched them on the ambulance call with about 50 minutes response times one way in certain areas.
Mr. McAlpin, what's a PSAP?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Primary Service Answering Point or the Sheriff's Office Dispatch Center, where they're paged out to. So our board of directors voted unanimously this year to wholeheartedly support moving forward with the governor's proposal in his budget to fund the armor system, and most importantly to us was to pay for operations costs. We can't have ambulance services that do 50 runs a year in west central Minnesota pay $200-$300 to be on a portable radio to the Department of Transportation. And with the governor's budget and the folks at the commissioner's office, Commissioner Leslie and Campion, they heard our cries that that cost can't be there for them to make it successful. With some of that stuff addressed, we felt that we could very definitely support the system as it moves forward. As towers were built, and hopefully, as Sheriff Maduri said earlier, cell phone communications seemed to come into the area, that we could use cell phones up there as even backup sources. But right now, we have a lack of VHF system. And sure want to see this system move forward. So so we can address all the needs of our communications. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen, very much. Do we have any of the skeptics in the room who'd like to come and talk to us? This has been wonderful to have everybody. Senator Rosen, you're going to speak some more?
I just said it, hold me.
Okay, is there anybody else who wants to speak on this? Okay, Senator Neville.
How many channels are there on 800 meg? Somebody said there's an awful lot, and if there's three for one fire station, there must be thousands, but what is the total capacity of individual frequencies that could be assigned out on this?
Andy, come here. Madam Chair, Andy Carey, the Director of the Office of Electronic Communications, could answer that question.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, before he confuses the dickens out of you, I'd like to say that in Olmsted County, we used to have two channels that were on repeater. That repeater is like a transformer that beefs up the signal enough that we could talk across the county. And one channel that was car to car, and then our statewide emergency channel. It's all we had for Olmsted County Sheriff's Office and Rochester Police Department. Now with our system, we have access. We eventually will have access to 10 frequencies. Currently, we're only using 5. This system allows us to have 4 zones of 16 talk groups per zone. It is phenomenal, the capacity that we have now that we never had before. We're sending people off in talk groups, and officers caught on to this within a week. We thought there would be some kind of slow turnover and build up and getting accustomed to how to use it. Within days, they were creating new talk groups and asking the dispatch center to accommodate them as they needed that to assist them in going about their communications. I just had to stand up and address that. The increase in capacity is absolutely phenomenal.
Madam Chair, members, Sheriff Borkert, maybe I've answered your question on capacity. The channel limitations that you've talked about in the past in the VHF spectrum won't exist in the 800 and 700 megahertz spectrum. We've got over 96 channels available for reuse throughout the state in just the 800 megahertz spectrum allocation. And then in the 700 megahertz spectrum that's adjacent to that, that is future growth opportunities, as Mr. Whitehead had mentioned, there's over 400 channel allotments that are for public safety utilization. But beyond just the capacity issues, I think one of the things that has been talked about quite a bit amongst some of the testifiers is the fact that this is a computer control system that basically creates virtual talk space. Everyone thinks in their minds about channel allocations, and that's really the old way that radio systems functioned. MnDOT has a radio system with its channel. Law enforcement has a radio system with its channel. Fire has a radio system with its channel. And when MnDOT's not talking on its radio system, that channel just lies fallow. It's not being used today, that airtime. Well, what the computer system does with a new trunk system is put all those channel allocations by any unit of government into a bucket and allocates that to whatever user might happen to need the radio space at that time. So you get a 9- to 10-fold additional capacity in your talk space by pooling your channel resources. So not only are there more channel resources, but they're used much more efficiently. And then if I could just spend 1 minute, my name's Andy Terry. I'm a Director of Electronic Communications for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. One of the questions earlier was related to MnDOT's role in the system, and we partner through a contract with the Department of Public Safety to construct, own, and operate the system, and that's traditionally been a role that the Department of Transportation has played for all state government. I'm a registered professional engineer, and I'm housed within the Department of Transportation, and that's really the role that we play is as the technical lead and the technical liaison. So we offer services not only to MnDOT and Department of Public Safety, but to other state agencies as well, as far as their design of technology systems, radio systems, and actually now have began to branch out and provide services to local units of government as well in the design and implementation of the communications infrastructure. And so I'll stand for any other questions that might be relevant to MnDOT.
Crystal clear now. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to speak to us about the armor system today? Well, thank you all for coming to talk to us. We're going to start on the CRIMNET presentation. We'll see how far we get. And if you're on your way home, drive carefully.
It was, wasn't it?
Tell them to abide by the speed limit.
I didn't hear you. Tell them what the speed limit is.
Tell them abide by the speed limit.
Yeah, abide by the speed limit, everybody.
Yeah.
Just like I don't. Big believer in the dimmer thing.
I think they all know that, but it's a different deal.
But that's a national deal.
No. Just all in all, we've been dealing with it here in the state for years. But when there is an incident,
Linda,
it's in a small,
clear as mud.
Small chief will be there.
I'm getting it. Yeah, it's going to cover better. So, Superintendent O'Malley, how does it feel that you come up to speak and everybody clears out of the room?
I had a couple comments for him. I won't share them with you, though.
Okay. Well, welcome today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of the BCA. And I guess the first thing I should do, Madam Chair, is just check in. I know this was supposed to end at 5, and we had some plans here. At least that's what I was told. Is it
5:30.
Okay. What I propose is I just wanted to take about 2 minutes and make two or three observations of about CRIMNET and put it in some context, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dale Good, who's really the BCA's point person on all of CRIMNET and knows it much better than I do, that's for sure. And there are a couple of other people here. I know Sheriff Olson and some others who may want to comment, and if you want to hear from them, I don't know if we want to try and accommodate that today or if you could come back if we don't get done, but however you want to do that. First of all, just before coming over here, Assistant Commissioner Leslie and I were at a meeting dealing with technology from about 1:30 till 2:30, quarter to 3. And in that, there's a perspective from the federal government that came out. And it was that they offered that their second highest priority nationwide for law enforcement is to come up with a way that information sharing can take place more timely and accurately across state lines and jurisdictional borders. And Tim then asked, well, what's the number one priority? And they said radio interoperability and the ability to communicate, not only during crisis, but just across jurisdictional lines anyway. So both of those topics really are at the heart of what we're here today for. At the BCA level, there are two areas, two key issues dealing with technology that seem to be right in front of us and that are coming to a head here this session and will continue for the next few years. One is forensics, and the other is the sharing of information. And I think I would suggest that both of those really go right to the heart of solving crime and right to the heart of public safety. The advances in forensics, both technology and business practice changes, can result in us being able to solve crimes and act more quickly and more thoroughly than we used to. And the same thing for the purposes today of CRIMNET, of being able to, in a very timely and accurate way, have information flow across all kinds of agencies and jurisdictions. My last comment before I turn it over to Dale would be that I would suggest that an awful lot of progress has been made in the CRIMNET arena and in the information sharing arena, both operationally, and I know he's going to give some examples, I think, but just one that always impresses me is that you go back 5, 6, 7 years and fingerprints were taken, were rolled, were hard copies, were mailed in through the mail, and the BCA would, there you go, the BCA would process those and get back to the sheriff's department, whoever booked them into a jail, and identify that person based on biometrics. You can tell me whatever name and date of birth you want, but your fingerprints are not going to change. That would take weeks. 100% of them 7 or 8 years ago were these cards that were sent through the mail. Today, 99% of the fingerprints transmitted to the BCA are done electronically. They're there within seconds, and instead of weeks for a turnaround, we're down to hours, and we're heading towards minutes. So while the person is still standing there saying, my name is Joe Smith, and here's my date of birth, and they put the fingerprints down, and it gets sent to the BCA within, it'll be seconds soon, we get back and say, no, that's not who you are. At least, here's your record. Here's who you say you were, the other people. That is real progress, and that is saving, that is public safety. And that's an operational advancement using technology and CRIMNET in order to make that happen. The most important change, though, I think, and the most important area of progress is our communication with our partners and our stakeholders. We have been and we will continue to be very candid. There have been setbacks. There have been glitches over the years. I think that now we are positioned better than ever. I've talked to a number of other states. Everybody's facing some of these same issues, both in forensics and in information sharing, and how it is that we're getting accurate information across agencies. We are now, I think, positioned because of the involvement and the input from an awful lot of people on the task force and on the policy group, that we are positioned to make some, I think, very bold strides and even build on the progress that's already been made. With that introduction, I'll turn it over to Mr. Good, if that's all right.
Thank you very much. Mr. Good, welcome back.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Dale Good. I'm the Executive Director of the CRIMNET program at the VCA. I report day-to-day to Superintendent O'Malley, and I report I'm hired and hopefully not fired by a policy group that is in statute. There is also a task force in statute that is the represents law enforcement, corrections, public defense, prosecutors, the whole spectrum, as well as the as well as some citizen members. Rich Neumeister has been in and out of here, that's on the task force. Senator Foley is the Senate representative on the task force. We have the chair of the task force, Deb Kirshner, here that can speak, as well as Bud Olson, who's on the task force representing the Sheriff's Association. Also with us is John Lally and Colleen Mellick. Did I get that right? With the Office of Enterprise Technology, and they provide some oversight on how well we're managed, how well our program management is doing, and that sort of thing. So they're available also for testimony. I have a brief presentation. I'm trying to slim this down further. What I'd like to do is to give you some context, spend some time with a little bit of context. Where did we start? There's a lot of questions. We've gone around, we've talked to the members of the committee. We've tried to anticipate the questions that you have, and we've built those responses to those questions that you've been asking us into this presentation. And I think one way of answering them is to give you a little bit of the history, a little bit of context, be very honest about where we went off course, where we've had some problems, where we're at today, really explain what CRIMNET is. It's that's been an issue, is what CRIMNET is and what it isn't. And then specifically talk about the recommendations in the governor's budget for the 2008-2009 biennium. I won't spend a lot of time on this. In the late 90s, when we tried to implement a domestic abuse order for protection system, we learned several things that were the precursors to trying to understand what we needed to do moving forward. One of the things that we learned is it's not just technology. Domestic abuse orders in the past, you know, there were court files and law enforcement files. Domestic abuse orders were pieces of paper. And the pieces of paper going to the party and going to the sheriff's office that's serving in a civil service process, that was the way it worked. So when we implemented the domestic abuse order protection system, we had to change business practices. Court staff were entering data they didn't have to do in the past. It was just a piece of paper. Sheriff's offices had to be able to respond to a hit confirmation from a squad car. Is this a valid order of protection? They had to be able to do that. They had to move their OFPs from one area of their office into their warrant area so they could do it day and night. We had to implement in statute a short-form service because once we automated this and the officer might be showing up at a protected address or dealing with a protected party and the respondent had not yet been served. Had not been legally served. So we had to change the whole business practice. This is just some of the early learnings. It's not just technology. It wasn't just from the courtroom to the squad car. It was all those changes that occurred around that. So just an example of that early learning process. 1998 to 2000, we had the Murderopolis, the tragic Murderopolis. Minneapolis is on Time magazine as, you know, Murderopolis. We had a number of very horrendous crimes, Kelly Jo Larson and Katie Poyer. We realized that Donald Blum was trying to avoid, as the superintendent said, is trying to avoid the system knowing who he was by changing his name and his date of birth, using his wife's name to get employment. We also had a lot of outside interest. We had a lot of public awareness of this. We had a community group, a corporate group in South Minneapolis, HEALS, Hope Education, can't remember the acronym, but it was then Honeywell, Alina Healthcare, some of the other corporations in South Minneapolis that became interested in this information problem, this information sharing problem. That was followed by the Minnesota Business Partnership, the 100 CEOs of the largest companies, and Target Corporation in particular that became, you know, Target is saying we can track SOX better than you can track your criminals. All, you know, true. So we had a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of interest in that end of the decade, the beginning of the 2000s. We tried to do a visual demonstration of what the public probably thought we had versus what we actually had as we started this decade. And this was before CSI. This was before the CSI effect, you know, where we have forensic files and CSI files and some of the problems you're dealing with on the other side of the operation. But the public would thought at that point that you could enter some information. You had a biometric identifier in the fingerprints. You had a booking photo, digital booking photo. You knew if the person was a registered sex offender. You knew if they were prohibited from purchasing or carrying a weapon. You knew their warrant status or want warrant status statewide. You knew their felony conviction status, the felony and gross misdemeanor serious conviction status statewide. You knew their misdemeanor criminal history. We have enhanceables. We have person misdemeanors in the domestic abuse area, violation of restraining orders, enhanceables that are more serious if you commit more than one, so you would assume that we would have that on file. You would know their probation status statewide, domestic abuse, are they respondent in a restraining order situation? Are they on release over here, and they're picked up over here? So the assumption is that the system, the Minnesota criminal justice system, has this information, and that we know if you're a serious juvenile offender, especially with EJJ and an adult certification, where we hold serious juveniles accountable in a different way than we do the less serious juvenile offenders. This is the most technical thing that he has ever done, I kind of think. But what do we really have? Again, this is 5 or 6 years ago. What did we really have? We were missing the weapon prohibition information. We were missing fingerprint information. We had Polaroids in most jurisdictions, not shareable. We had incomplete and mostly paper sex offender information. We had incomplete warrant, incomplete felony and gross misdemeanor conviction information. We had no misdemeanor information statewide. We had no probation detention information statewide. We had no pretrial release information, and we had no felony, serious juvenile offender criminal history information. And as the superintendent said, the fingerprints were coming in on cards, handwritten, typed, mailed to the BCA, 3 months to learn identity. And the records, the conviction records and the disposition records that came from the courts that weren't linked to fingerprints were not visible to the criminal justice system. As we go a little further, I'm going to bring you back to the progress and show you where we are at today. But I wanted to juxtapose what the public probably thought, 99-2000, versus what we actually had. And so, really, it was a recognition of the gaps. There were records. Those records were paper. Those were the gaps that we were trying to fill, is automate. We were still catching up trying to automate some of these records. This is just a real quick example of one of our struggles. Here's an individual. These are his alias names and dates of birth. He was our poster child, you know, not someone you want to bring home to your daughter to bring home to mom, to meet mom. What was his record? Well, when we analyzed his record, we had 6 of his offenses on the state criminal history database. He actually had 21 offenses that were in various locations that were not collected anywhere. That's just one example. We actually had to walk names and dates of birth at his aliases through different record systems to find out what this individual was really involved in. And that's what people were doing at that point in time, is phone calls and walking through other record systems and other paper systems. 2000-2001, this is the establishment of the CRIMNET program. The initial funding under what we would call CRIMNET today, this the integration project, was $13 million, and this was to fill some of these gaps, fingerprint capture to try to get past paper fingerprints, the statewide supervision system, which is probation, detention, and release information, the beginning of the statewide court information system, booking photos. So this was the initial effort to fill some of the gaps, followed by a $27 million one-time appropriation. And some of these have tails, so I want to say these are kind of the one-time with tails, the initial appropriations to fill these gaps. And it was in this 2001 appropriation that the CRIMNET program office was officially created. And I want to make a distinction between the CRIMNET program office, of which I'm a part, and the CRIMNET enterprise, which we're all of our practitioners, all of our criminal justice professionals are a part of. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. Okay, this is where we hit a bump. And I think, Sheriff Olson, this is about the time that you started as a stakeholder on the task force and kind of close-in stakeholder. The program back then had an exclusive focus on technology. It was building a thing. Unfortunately, they were using the term backbone, which sounds an awful lot like the armor backbone. There was little stakeholder involvement or input. There was no plan. It was oversimplified, overpromised, and underdelivered. And there was no understanding or interest in the real business practice issues, the real day-to-day business practice issues in the criminal justice system. What was the result of that? We're still chasing that today. We are still chasing expectations that were they set a very high bar of expectations and under-delivery and oversimplification, and we are still chasing that today. This was followed in 2003, 2004, the beginning of a turnaround. A new executive director was appointed. My predecessor is the CJIS director at the BCA. The program focused took on a business focus, not a pure technology focus. A comprehensive plan, strategic plan, was developed and vetted with our stakeholders, with our task force, and our constituents. At the same time, then, we hit another bump. The legislative auditor released a legislative audit of that 2002-2003 period, released that in 2004, a very critical audit of the CRIMNET program that was, on the one hand, it was very critical, justifiably critical. On the other hand, it continued to support the mission of integration in Minnesota, of information sharing in Minnesota. So it was positive in one sense that, you know, I think it's Sheriff Olson says that it's too important to fail. You know, we have to succeed. So yet it was very critical of how we were going about it. We had another major bump, which was the MJNO. For those newer members, this was a comprehensive law enforcement data that had mixed classifications and did not have appropriate security. There was a breach of that. That resulted in a very, very difficult discussion around data practices in 2004. So starting to recover, legislative audit, this MJNO that kind of set us back from a data policy perspective. Where have we gone since then? 2005, 2006, and I'm just going to touch on these. There's a lot of activities here. I don't want to go through all of them. We are going around to members. We have a briefing packet. We're trying to provide more detail. We have an annual report that's been provided to the committee and the members, but just a couple examples. Policy. We are working on data policy. We take data policy very serious. We take these privacy issues very serious. We go forward. If we're going to collect new information, last session we came forward to you to get the data policy for one of the initiatives that's being recommended for funding. In advance of that, we've asked for a data classification for our name event index service, and you passed that for us last session. We take security very seriously. We developed a security architecture because sharing across agencies and across data systems is even more complex than security within a single agency. We continue to struggle with trying to get the comprehensive law enforcement, the incident data, to get that because that's a very, very strong interest in law enforcement. We continue to look at the role that identification and identification technology should play in these record systems and how these records should be linked. These are just a couple of examples. Just maybe a bullet, that last bullet. We've tried to, with the task force, and Deb is here to testify when we're done, we have tried to identify an end state vision and the various investment options to achieve those goals, those outcomes, those specific business outcomes for your consideration. And we know you are making tough choices. By statute, we are responsible to come to this committee and tell you what the criminal justice system thinks, the practitioners and our task force, our public members and our victims, what they think the priorities are in information integration going forward. And that's what we're doing, recognizing that you have to take that and make those choices amongst all the other competing pressures that you have on spending this money. But we're obligated to tell you what we think the state needs to invest in criminal justice information technology. Okay, this is where we were in 1999, just to bring this a little bit up to date. We have almost complete fingerprint records. We have electronic booking photos in all but 30 of the smaller sheriff's offices around the state. We have Brady information or weapon prohibition information. We have a complete sex offender registry. I think it's recognized nationally, complete and accurate sex offender registry. We have a more complete felony conviction record. We still have challenges. We have more complete warrants. We have a statewide, thanks to the leadership of the Department of Corrections, we have a statewide probation and detention system. We have a juvenile felony criminal history, albeit with some records that are in suspense or not linked to fingerprints. We have our domestic abuse restraining order system. We have pretrial, again, with statewide supervision, the Department of Corrections system. We have the statewide release information. And as of early 2005, we have all targeted misdemeanors from 2002 to date. And we are going back, as MNSIS, as the new court information system is implemented, we're going back to 1997 when the targeted misdemeanor classification was enacted and bringing those on the criminal history.
Mr. Good, can I ask what a targeted misdemeanor is, please?
In statute, I don't have the specific reference. In statute, there is there are a number of misdemeanors that are called targeted misdemeanors. They are primarily enhanceables, where if you commit more than one, it's a more serious, it's a potential more serious conviction, or some of the person misdemeanors. So by statute, you've identified, the legislature has identified those that are, it's a classification of the more, either enhanceable or more serious misdemeanors.
Okay. Senator Foley?
I just point out offenses like drunk driving, DUI.
Okay.
Abuse of a restraining order, failing to, you know, to follow a restraining order, domestic assault. There's a number. There's eight or nine, I believe. I can get that reference to you.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Good, does that categorize then what their offense was?
I'm sorry?
Does it categorize? I mean, it shows exactly what their offense was when it comes up?
Madam Chair,
what
Senator
they were charged with?
Senator Rosen, yes, it does. So the targeted misdemeanor part of criminal history shows what they were arrested for or charged with, okay, as well as what they're convicted of.
Okay.
But if I could add one thing, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen, in the old days of the fingerprint cards, misdemeanors might not have even been fingerprinted. We might not have had a biometric measure, those types of things. Now that it can be done so efficiently, we're seeing more and more, and I think you're going to get to the point of how many criminal records we now have and how accurate they are compared to years ago. So that's good, accurate information to have in hand when before we never had misdemeanors at all, I don't think.
That kind of speaks to the up in the upper right-hand corner. By capturing them electronically, we're able to return identity back to the booking location or wherever the location of the submission is in a couple hours, you know, from 3 months to 2 hours, moving to 2 minutes. We're a year, less than a year away from returning it in 2 minutes. That lets us do all sorts of additional things that we can talk about.
Yeah,
and then the other note on the bottom, the little yellow sticky down there on the bottom, is that those dispositions that aren't linked to fingerprints, and there's some issues, that's still a challenge for us, they're at least visible to the criminal justice agencies. They're not visible in some of the statutory background checks, which is another issue that we have on the policy side that we'd be talking about on the policy side. Okay, what is CRIMNET? There's still some confusion. I want to try to get that nailed down if at all possible. CRIMNET is a program, so it's a state program. It's housed in the BCA. The program office, which is approximately 20-some-odd people that work on these business practices, the data policy issues, the strategic planning. So there's a small group of people that's the CRIMNET program office that works with our stakeholders, with our task force and our policy group, and the associations, the various associations, to try to identify priorities for moving forward. And by statute, we are required to recommend to you, to the governor, the chief justice, and the chairs of both funding bodies, recommended investments in information technology going forward. The program office is a base budget of $3.1 million. Often, the appropriations in the past, so if you look back to the 2001, those appropriations were to Department of Public Safety, to the Department of Corrections, to the court system, to some grants for local agencies or some local costs. So just make that clear. When we've recommended appropriations, and this time the recommendations that are in the governor's budget all go to the Department of Public Safety, the BCA, just so that's clear. But the program office itself is a small piece of this that works on the planning the data practices, the standards to help make this happen. And just another, to try to put this in perspective, I haven't updated this. I need to update this. This is in from 2004. This is the funding on operations. So what do we spend, the small cities, the large cities, the counties, and the state, what do we spend on operations? So again, we're, you know, while these are some large numbers that the legislature has appropriated in the past, I'd like to put those appropriations against what we spend to operate. We spend, in 2004 as an example, and it grows, we spent $2.4 billion to operate to provide justice and public safety services statewide. So we have a very small investment in this information technology to get the electronic data so it's shareable, and we've made that progress. We've made a lot of progress doing that, and I would argue that this the investment the state has made, the legislature has appropriated, is a good investment in an enterprise that cost it then $2.4 billion a year to operate. And what does it do? It makes at every stage, it's making decisions. At a traffic stop, before an officer approaches a squad car, an investigator in a back room, a probation officer that's helping a judge, you know, decide, providing information to a judge on a release calendar and arraignment calendar, the sentencing decisions, the probation monitoring, the decision about correctional programming, all of those things are dependent on information. And we're spending $2.4 billion a year back then to do that. And doing it, you know, and until now, we've been doing it with less than complete information, or we've been doing it with information that's mostly paper and not shareable. Next steps, I'm going to summarize this, and then we'll talk of the specific initiatives in the budget book. The next step is to integrate the silos. We filled these gaps. So we had the paper gaps. We filled them with separate computer systems, okay? What we need to do today, the criticisms you'll hear today, is the information is there, but they're spending a lot of time looking in different systems to try to make decisions, to try to decide what information or how to make a decision. So the next step is consolidating the information that's helpful to the users, linking that information electronically, and linking it in the future as best we can to fingerprints. Again, that point that as many records as possible should be indexed and linked to fingerprints. And we have to be able to deliver it. Instead of you today, you know, you'll go, okay, what's on the court record? What's on the probation, statewide supervision record? You shouldn't have, if you're in a squad car or you're in a courtroom, you should be able to say, what do I need to know? I should be able to say, this is the information, you know, I need to make this decision. I'm a judge or a probation officer, and that information should be returned to you without you having to know where it came from or have to sort through it. And I use the metaphor of orbits. When I want to book a flight and buy a ticket, an airplane ticket, airline ticket, I go to a screen, I put in some information. It may be touching four or five different airline reservation systems, three or four. I decide what to purchase. It takes my frequent flyer number. It sends the information to the airline. It takes my credit card. It sends to a bank, which sends the money to the airlines. That's where we need to get to. Right now, we still have these silos that aren't linked, where we have so much time invested in the data's there, but now we're having to try to sort through it and provide it back in a much more useful fashion. Again, within data policy, within the appropriate data policy, and as I said, in the case of this name event index service, our first priority, we already have the data. Last session we came forward and you granted us the authorization to collect this information. Just one last note on that last bolded sentence there. This integrate the silos, consolidate, link, deliver is the top priority of our task force. Specifically on the budget book, page 29, these are the initiatives that are, you know, this gets into the acronyms and more technical detail, but these are the components of these core priorities. So I'm not going to talk about the first four. I'm going to talk about the fifth and sixth. So the first four are those to be able to consolidate, to be able to deliver back to the based on the role in the event. We also have to replace live scan units that were purchased under Katie's law in 2000. We have 100 some odd lives, these fingerprint, electronic fingerprint capture. Again, if the state hadn't done it, we'd still be getting cards. But some of those have reached the end of their useful life. So 5.7, approximately 5.2 of the request is to replace those LifeScan units that were purchased under Katie's law. However, we do get the additional benefit that the new devices also capture palm prints. And 40%, we're told in the states that are doing this, approximately 40% of the latent crime scene prints are palm prints. So this supports our latent processing section at the BCA by statewide being able to also, when we ink and roll, or not ink, but when we roll on a LifeScan device, in addition to the fingers, we're going to capture the palm that helps our latent processing. Lastly, the other initiative, and this is a small part, $1.2 million, is to update the criminal justice reporting system to take cybers to take our comprehensive incident-based reporting system as we implement that, take that a step further, and try to be compliant with the federal reporting, NIBRS-like reporting, and to replace a 30-year-old ancient system that's no longer being supported. These are the LifeScan replacement sites. So of that $15.5 million, 42% is either equipment that will be placed locally or is resources to help fund the changes that the counties that participate in these pilots to help pay for their costs. So included in this budget is approximately 42% of either equipment that's going to go into the counties or funds that will help support participating in these initiatives in their local jurisdiction. This is what Superintendent O'Malley referenced. Again, looking back, the backdrop of what we were playing catch-up, trying to get rid of paper, at the same time, our serious crime rate from 1995 to 2005 went up 54.1%. I think you've heard that from the court system when they testify. Our DWI cases just in the last few years are up 18.6%. Fingerprints taken. We could not, if we were still doing this, we would be so drowned in paper it would be impossible. The fingerprints taken have increased 242%. We didn't have electronic ones till starting in 2001 when the state invested in this. This is just another more context. Again, if I go back as we were in the 90s, 2000s, as we were trying to make these changes, this is our estimate using the state auditor's website and the Senate's website of what, in that 10-year period, what the state spent to operate, $26 billion. So if we spent even 1% of our operating cost to fund these technologies, that's $260 million. Even 1%. Madam Chair, members, we have Deb and Sheriff Olson to kind of come up and reinforce the, hopefully.
Yes, I for sure want to get people who are here from out of town who.
So, Sheriff, you want to first?
Sheriff?
I'm from out of town.
Hmm? You from out of town?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Kirshner, for the record, and I'm with the Department of Corrections, and I'm the Department of Corrections representative on the CrimNet Task Force. However, today I'd like to just briefly talk to you, not as a member of the Department of Corrections, but as the chair of the CrimNet Task Force. As Dale has alluded to and has mentioned, the task force is statutorily created to assist the CrimNet Program Office and the policy group in its responsibilities for integrating criminal justice data statewide. And recognizing the importance of the participation of all of the facets of the criminal justice system, the statute actually allocates specific representation. So I'm speaking to you on the behalf not just of my department, but also the fact that the task force represents law enforcement, both the sheriff's office, and Sheriff Olson is here speaking to that, but also police chiefs, county attorneys, the judiciary, public defenders, probation officers, community corrections representatives. We have 4 public member slots. We have representatives from court administration. We have representatives from state agencies such as my department, public safety, and the Attorney General, as well as the Association of Minnesota Counties and the League of Minnesota Senate, cities. We also have a representative from the House and the Senate, and as Dale also mentioned, Senator Foley is an active and valuable member of our task force. We also have a representative from the victim community. The task force takes very seriously its responsibilities in representing all of our constituencies, and in fact, we have taken steps over the past year to ensure that all of our slots are indeed appointed by their constituent groups so that we do have that representation. The task force has worked actively with the CRIMNET program office and with the policy group in ensuring that the efforts that continue in integrating data across these various systems and for our enterprise are done in such a way that our constituencies all benefit. The priorities that Dale has mentioned, the task force was actively involved beginning last summer in identifying these priorities and also taking those priorities back and working with our constituent groups and getting the input from those groups that I've already mentioned. The task force then consolidated all of that input and literally identified what is the highest priority that we need to be working on in the next 2 to 5 years so that we can truly successfully integrate criminal justice information across the state. And again, the bottom line is for public safety, and that's what the task force takes very seriously. So the task force passed those priorities on through the CRIMNET program office to the policy group, and literally what was created was an integration plan or an integration framework. And that framework was the basis for the budget recommendations that you have before you. So again, the task force represents truly the criminal justice enterprise across the state, and we have been actively involved in setting those priorities and passing them on through the program office. So actually, on behalf of the task force, I would like to thank you for your consideration, and I would like to encourage your support in these essential efforts for data integration for our criminal justice agencies.
Thank you, Ms. Kirchner. Chair Foles?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I get the privilege of being up here twice for in one day in one spot. Well, that was good for me. I thank you for that. I just want to... My dad was a meat gutter in Marshall, Minnesota, growing up. And when I'd go in and watch him do his job, the process was just awful. But the outcome was good. And I've been part of this mission here, this journey of CRIMNET, since 2002 as a representative of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. And you know, I'm sorry to say some of the analogy is the same as my father's profession, but I have to tell you that in my 30 years of law enforcement, I don't know of another option that we should be thinking of that is so important to public safety. I have had a brother-in-law killed in the line of duty, and we had incomplete information on his killer and why he was out. There has been examples of the Poyers and the Swansons, and we have tough cases to do in law enforcement. And so to have this type of integration and this type of communication and collaboration is imperative. And I know we have a lot of budget discussions and a lot of budget priorities, but I just need you to support this because it does, from the grassroots, does work on the street. We just did a small project with the BCA now. It's called Two-Finger Rapid Identification System. Sounds really great. But what it did is on a night that we put it in service after we had just finished training our staff in the jail how to use it, we had a deputy that made a traffic stop, a simple traffic stop, and found some drugs on a person in the car. We made the arrest on the individual, giving us a name that we thought was accurate and complete. When we brought him into jail, our alert staff said, well, let's use this new technology. And within minutes, a hit came back from the BCA, and these fingerprints went through the Hennepin County fingerprint system, the Ramsey County, and the BCA. And lo and behold, the gentleman we thought we knew who we had was identified as a different person, and he had a felony warrant out of McLeod County for drug possession. So we were able to instantaneously find out who this character really was. And for law enforcement, as our good Senator Ingebrigtsen knows from his experience, they don't always tell us the truth.
And so sometimes we have to use other means to identify people. So on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, I can tell you that this is an area that we support strongly. So I thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who'd like to? Senator Neville.
I need to have my memory refreshed every session, I guess, but you're the task force, so you make recommendations to the policy group. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. The task force represents the 30-some different entities. We pass recommendations to the policy group, which is composed of the four state agencies and four representatives from the Supreme Court.
So has the policy group endorsed everything that you've recommended?
That's correct.
On this? Okay.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I don't want to, it's late, I don't want to digress too much, but have any of you read over in Iraq? This is an issue as well, that they were having trouble identifying who the good guys and the bad guys were, and somehow they raised $30,000 and they went out, they've got a laptop computer, and they now measure with biometric finger, they take the fingerprint to identify the guys that they have arrested before, and they're everything we're talking about here, they don't have over in Iraq. And so they're getting the very basic finger biometrics systems going. Apparently a lot of the Iraqis think we're implanting chips in their fingers when we put them on that. But it's exactly the same kind of thing that we're doing. We just, obviously go farther. It's amazing that the Army can't do that. And that they haven't done it for 4 years. It's one of the problems.
Going into the Cub store by my house, if you don't want to drag your credit card and your driver's license and everything, they've got a little thing where you can put your finger in and it gets the biometrics.
And Madam Chair, that's the similar device to the that the sheriffs were referring to.
Is that that two-finger thing you were talking about?
Cool. That's the example. It's a similar technology to the pilot that the sheriff is doing with this IBIS, this rapid ID.
So you're hooking into Cub?
No. I'm just saying. I'm just saying the technology is similar.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to talk to us about CrimNet while we're here, while we've got you?
Let me ask one more question.
Sure.
Mr. Goods, do we have law enforcement vehicles that do have those fingerprint IDs?
On a pilot basis, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, on a pilot basis, yes, sir.
Pilot basis.
Okay.
About how many police cars do you think?
200
or
approximately.
How many
200 devices approximately. Some are tethered. Some are tethered to workstations, which I think is what the sheriff has, and some are wireless.
Okay.
We had a hearing on that former Senator Kelly was in your position. That's a long time
ago. That's a while ago.
Yeah. But we, I remember seeing a little bit of a demonstration on that. And so we're still only at the pilot stage. Okay.
Mm. Again, this is a lot of these investments are positioning us to roll that out statewide. So to do this in minutes, we need to have the BCA be able to return, which we're getting to. So there's a lot of building blocks to get that statewide.
Madam Chair, my name is John Lally. Members, I'm the Director of Planning at the Office of Enterprise Technology. And Dale asked if we would try to bring you up to date on our relationship with this project and tell you why that's important. If there's a poster child for a project that could go bad, it's this one. Multi-jurisdictional, multiple technologies from everything from paper to the most advanced, multiple levels of government, long-term duration, a lot of governing issues, and a lot of project management complexities. It's no secret why projects go bad. We had somebody working with this project in the late 90s and early years trying to constantly raise issues about the project management, the lack of control over scope, the lack of a solid plan, and all the sort of things that add to a system going south. As Mr. Good identified in his presentation about 4 or 5 years ago, it was very serious and it was likely to impact the success of this project. I'm happy to report that the nature of our relationship has changed dramatically with this project. We have gone from sitting there and pounding on tables and complaining about how things are going to where we now have a relationship where we've identified that the management of this project, all the different elements that go into solid project management. Any place else, they call them best practices. In Minnesota, we call them pretty good practices. are now being observed, and we're very pleased with the quality of planning, very pleased with the nature of the project management discipline that's employed here, and have been very open with Dale and his staff, and the other way has gone as well. so that we have a much higher level of confidence in this project and in its direction and in its leadership than we would have had even 5 years ago. So, and we now have one of our agency executives sitting on the task force as well as the other people that were identified.
Thanks, Mr. Malley.
My name is Colleen Melka, Assistant Commissioner with the Office of Enterprise Technology, and I'll be very brief, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to say that my time on the task force has been brief, but I've been impressed with the quality of the work that that group does. From a technology perspective, which is my particular interest here, we're working very closely with the CRIMNET program office and those systems that Dale described that they're developing. To the extent that we can leverage the enterprise technology, we're doing that. In some cases, the CRIMNET program folks are actually developing reusable components that could become a center of excellence for deployment of other enterprise systems.
Great. Thank you. Questions? All right. Well, as we're going along, we know now that we've got lots of good people we can ask questions of, and thank you all very much for coming in and educating us on this issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. We are adjourned.